are back and excited to continue this conversation with John Cox, who will be curating NE10 at the National Art Gallery of the Bahamas, your favorite museum. I'm Diana Sands.
And I'm Douglas Barkey.
And I'm John Cox. Right.
Hey, John, it's been great talking to you about the theme for the exhibit of mercy for the NE10. And we've really kind of dug into some of the meaning of mercy and how you see this show in a way as a national dialogue about it, the timing of it coming after the pandemic. We have things happening in Russia. We have things happening that just seem to beg.
Never, you know? A dull moment.
Yeah, yeah. So it's the timing just seems to be perfect for this particular conversation. You're talking a little about the response of the artists so far and how they responded to you and to the theme, of course. And you yourself have, not only you're an artist, but you also have lots of experience working with artists as mm-hmm. a curator, because you used to be chief curator at the NAGB. Do you remember the years that was?
That would have been, I think, from 2009 to 2012, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, great. Yeah. And now you're really over at The Current, where you really do this, and you're not only leading the entire operation, but you're obviously doing mm-hmm. curation for exhibits there. Can you tell us a little more about your role at The Current and Bahamar? You know, what are some of the highlights of your work there, and what do you have to look forward to?
Yeah, absolutely. So definitely, yeah. So I guess technically my role at Bahamar is I'm the executive director for arts and culture for the resort. And so what that means is that everything that's art and culture related for the resort, for the most part, falls under some layer of structure that I'm responsible for. The Current is like the brick and mortar part of that, right? Mm-hmm. That's the thing that everybody knows about. It's the physical space that's in the rotunda where the gallery is, where the store is, where the studio is, and, you know, so on and so forth. So we have a lot of art going on there, lots of opportunities, lots of programs, things all throughout the property. But I think what I'm going to focus on for this conversation is, I think, what is most interesting in terms of a comparison between, like, what it's like to curate for what it's like to be a curator for mm-hmm. a national gallery or a mm-hmm. museum versus what it's like to be a curator for a commercial gallery.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Where the goals are very, very different. And also, there's so many caveats. There's so many things to consider, right? So let me start here. So the whole upswing of, let's just talk about visual artists, the visual mm-hmm. arts part, the Bahamas has been experiencing a gradual and steady upswing in terms of not just the number of practitioners, but the complexity of work. And the industry has been evolving for the last probably 5 decades, right? Like, it's mm-hmm. just always one step more. There's another gallery. There's more artists. There's more. This artist are doing these things. It's a lot more dimensional. The challenge of curating The Current versus curating an exhibition like the NE10 is what was why I'm so excited to do it. Is The Current and the other commercial galleries like Turn and Cab mm-hmm. and the other ones, right?
Hillside.
Hillside and 6260 and so on and so forth, is that you want, there's an industry part, mm-hmm. right? Like right. cultural development and academic development and museum culture is not necessarily creative industry, right? It's right. not, it doesn't affect the economy necessarily. I mean, you have this revenue streams that could control these institutions or whatever, but they often exist like the way universities exist. They're either some not-for-profit or they're kind of set up right. as right. as they are in their configuration. When you have a commercial entity that its goal to stay open is that it needs to make money, the mission at this point for all of us who are effectively gallery owners, right? I'm told by my superiors at Bahamar that you're the business owner. Mm-hmm. Like, you own The Current. So you right. need to behave like The Current is yours. Mm-hmm. And every business decision that you make is about money. Do you make a decision? There's an ROI on that. If I'm going to spend $100 on this. Do I think I'm going to be able to make $1,000 on it? When is that going to mm-hmm. happen? Or right. I'm going to spend $500 on something that I don't think is going to have a tangible return, but this $500 is going to be worth it because it's going to right. create visibility. So those types of decisions when you're putting together an exhibition are quite different. And what you want to do ideally is you don't really want to sacrifice the integrity on both sides of the coin too much, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the reason I talked about this gradual upswing in the Bahamas over the last 5 decades, and we could go beyond that, I'm sure, is that the majority, I think, of what people were focusing on or accustomed to here was kind of like a cultural, critical kind of currency, right? Where the works mm-hmm. that works were in museums and being, you know, like that's the first thing we started to do. You started to see people included in museums here and that and the next thing. And those things, those works that are in museums don't necessarily have to have commercial viability.
No, no. In fact, it's interesting.
They often don't. But that's not across the board. But well, you could look at some very, very successful artists, right? Mm-hmm. You could go to the, let's just take the Museum of Modern Art, right? It's like a Western European pinnacle. Like I just like mm-hmm. you know, epitomizes the success of that, right? You have Andy Warhol, you have Robert Rauschenberg, you have all these people in there who are in these museums who are part of the, you know, Amanda Colson always talks about this, like we're talking about the canon, we're contributing to the canon, like we're putting these artists into the canon, into the art historical narrative, right? And that's what you're doing. And those people are also quite commercially successful, mm-hmm. right? And so one thing kind of informs the other thing, right? The acclaim of being, hey, I've been in the NE, I've been in this thing, I've been in the museum of this, I'm in this Cuban, you know, I'm in the region or whatever, it helps the commercial viability of the work. And so curating for the NE10, I can get deeply philosophical and talk about mm-hmm. mercy and have these quotes and have all these nuances and be very emotive. When I'm curating for the current, I have to have like a slightly different hat. I have to go, okay, I need to be able to work with artists that are going to be open to how this work is going to need to be commercialized. How much does this work cost? Mm-hmm. Are they going to be willing to negotiate the sale? Are they going to be making more work like this? Because, you know, people will want to buy stuff. They want to buy into the artist's kind of portfolio and their development. They don't want to know that just some guy made one thing and this is interesting, so I'm going to spend, you know, a large amount of money on it. And you have to start thinking strategically about, like, who are the best people to work with? The aesthetic part, the critical rigor that goes into the works that are in the museum context is not so dissimilar than the what goes into the commercial space, but you have to think about it in a different way, right? Mm-hmm. If I need to make X, I need to make $100,000. Right. I can either sell like $250,000 paintings, or I can sell like $100,000 paintings. I could sell $500 paintings, and that's you have to be thinking. Like that, it's like running a play on a football field. Like you need to be able to run the play because the end of the day, the sustainability of your space is about the revenue that comes back into the gallery because the gallery, commercial galleries are not sustained by anything else but the revenue that they generate.
That's right.
And so that has been a difficult, one of the more difficult things to develop recently because I feel like that's the vacant seat at the table, at the adult creative arts table right now is like how do artists manage their professional life, not mm-hmm. their critical life, not their, you know, I'm sure, you know, there's lots of essays being written and discourses and journal publications and everything else like that. But how do I sit there and go like, how am I going to make this work commercially viable? Either with a gallery as a conduit, like the current or Turn or Cab that acts as an agent that deals with that takes away some of the burden of the artist and then manages what they have to do and so on and so forth and thinks about the timing and what you should do and when you should do it and who you should do it with and all of those things. That's a really different type of conversation. So when you look, like take for instance, we had a show open at the current a few weeks ago, Defying Tropicality. Just the thinking about the back end of that show was very different to the thinking of the back end of what's going to you see in a show that's at NAGB.
Right.
Completely different.
Yeah, I mean, I want to respond to that a little bit, John, because that's a really interesting discussion about the art market. And the Gallery Curtain is very responsive to the market and really is driven by the market and what's available. I see the NAGB as a resource for artists, one. So it's there to not only look and see other artists, but also it's a resource for career development. Because you have the opportunity to develop in a way in a vacuum without the commercial concerns for a while, right? It also, interesting connection between the two different kinds of galleries and thinking about curation is that in both cases, certain voices are privileged. So when we make the selection, when you choose the five or six artists, well, 11 Strong, for example, mm-hmm. the show that's going on now, you know, those 11 Strong, that's those are 11 voices that were chosen, privileged to mm-hmm. speak and be illustrated as we go to any 10 or any exhibit we do. You know, our show, our schedule for the next 2 years, we're basically privileging voices that are then heard. And as you mentioned, the value of their work is then promoted and extended across the country. And so it's interesting, they both work hand in hand, but the NAGB is sort of doesn't have that concern of having to have – the ROI is very different. I mean, ROI is how many people can see the show.
Right.
Can we promote the artist? Can we do education? Interesting, we were talking about galleries. You didn't mention Pro Gallery, mm-hmm. which has an education
right,
mission.
Of course, yes.
Which, again, is another kind of a third variation.
Sure.
Because there you're trying to teach people about art, and particularly students.
And gallery operations as well.
Yes, right. And that's kind of a mix right. between the two sides, because you're yeah. trying to teach students about the art market and about the aesthetic challenge also being an artist.
Right.
The other thing I thought interesting, too, about where you're talking, the line you got to walk, because you can't go all the way over to commercial-only interest, because then you lose the conceptual, ethical, I guess, value that's being promoted in the art.
Yeah.
The art just becomes completely decorative.
Right.
Whereas, so you want to have the idea, you want to have challenge there, but you want to have it be the kind that people are willing to buy and exhibit in their homes and corporations and so on.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a great discussion.
Right.
And one I think that we need to have more debate and discussion around.
Yeah. Yeah. I often think I said that I think one time I was an interviewer or something. I said that working at Bahamar has made me recognize what the balance between the problems and the possibilities are. Right. And it's almost like you're like on a, you know, like in the Winter Olympics and those guys are bobsledding and they're on that thing and like you can't touch either a wall, like they start to lose speed if they hit up against this wall or the next thing. You have to be perfectly aligned in the middle. And if you're driving your sled really well, you will have a very positive outcome. Like, mm-hmm. like these are the metaphors, because there are definite problems. If you, like you say, if the pendulum swings too far, I think the worst thing that you could say to an artist is that you sold out. Mm-hmm. That just is like soul destroying for people. But the other problem with that is also that, I mean, we used to joke about this when I was in art school. People used to have all these little sayings. They'd say, like, you know, you got to sell out to eat out, right? So you could either, like, what do you want, right? And so it's a conversation that we even have challenges with now at Bahamar, because we are at the current, I should say, around like limited rights to reproduce work. Mm-hmm. Some artists feel like even a reproduction of my work is a form of me selling out. I don't want my work to be reproduced.
Because
it's not the original. And it must mean that I'm in a town. I'm going to put this in some arena that is not the desired arena. But then there's also this other thing where artists don't want to be seen as like being elitist. Mm-hmm. And you want to be successful. So you want your paintings to be selling for $20,000 and $30,000 and $40,000.
But then that
moves you away from the people who apparently the work is about, because that's how you keep it real. But you want to be super successful and expensive, but you don't want to reproduce the work because that's going to make you a sellout. So there's all these things that you have
to. But it gives accessibility.
It makes you much more accessible. I think that a lot of artists are coming around to like finding a way. I mean, that's what I think is interesting about. I mean, we didn't talk about this with any 10, and I mean, these are all ambitious goals or whatever. But like, even with building the exhibition, just like the merchandising of it, like, where does the shop come into this? Where does apparel come into this? Like, I think that there's all these opportunities to kind of do this. And I think some people who are in other creative industries, like apparel, get it in a different type of way, because they go like, wow, these things have to be bought. Like, can I have Martha Stewart has her line of things in Target, as far as I'm understanding.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right. And so you have a way of doing.
But she's very high elitist, but she's got.
But she's got the stuff. Yeah. And then there's this guy, Virgil Abloh, is a designer who recently passed away, who did all these things. Right. He was the creative director for men's apparel for Louis Vuitton. And he was an architect and an engineer and did stuff for IKEA and all these things. And he said, well, I think people should be able to have really well-appointed design mm-hmm. items for their apartments who are not wealthy. So I think that this rug, I'm going to design this rug, and this rug costs $75, and you can get it. And you can get this desk, and you can get that shelf, and that whatever. And it's all designed by, like, I'm a...
Like, the design's
incredible. I'm a premier designer, and I'm deliberately putting it into the realm of this. Mm-hmm. While simultaneously designing a coat for Louis Vuitton that probably costs $18,000. Mm-hmm. Right? So right. It's like, I think that one thing that I'm learning, and this is a difficult thing, I think, for a lot of people to deal with, is that more things can be true at the same time. I think people have this kind of like monolithic right. idea that right. only one ideology That's can true. Exist yeah. at a time. And I think that you can have multiple things existing at the same time. And that's what we need to, that's what we're really what we need to do, you know? And I think we need to be strategic about creating opportunities for people to realize how to make their practice more commercially viable, because it's good for them. It's empowering for them. Mm-hmm. I talk about the current exhibitions that we have to make X amount of dollars on. That's good for them. I mean, we call it cost of sale, right? So we have a 35-65 split. So if we need to make, I'm just picking a number. If we need to make $100,000 on these three exhibitions, that really means that there's $65,000 that just went into the creative community through the pockets of whoever right. these artists are. Right. Now, if they have any kind of...
So everyone's winning now.
Everyone's right. winning. They're going to put it back into their practice, hopefully, and yeah. continue to make more work. Or maybe they're going to put it into some... filter that into some other collaboration where another artist is going to get it. So it helps. Like, so sometimes, man, that reproduction that you could sell for $80 now instead of, you know, $1,500 for the original or $2,500 for the original one, we can sell this reproduction for $60 or $70 or $80. All of a sudden is making, it's not mm-hmm. just sustaining the gallery, because I think that's one of the kind of ugly things too. Like, people look at it and go like, oh, it's just like I'm just feeding the corporate monster and I'm just giving the money. Right. And it's like, well, yes, you are, but you're also
feeding yourself.
You're also feeding yeah. yourself. And you're also eating out.
Yeah. Well, you know,
or you're also eating. Yeah, eating in, even.
The issue of accessibility is really important, I think, especially for the NAGB.
Right.
Because if you talk about an artist making a livelihood, and then they make a painting, and the painting, they can sell that painting for $30,000, that's great, but they've just tapped into, as you mentioned, the elite group only. So if you're able to, say, make a limited edition prints that then other people, the public, can buy for a more reasonable amount, you then extend it into their lives, their homes, their appreciation of the arts has just multiplied incredibly when right. they'll do that. Plus, as an artist, you'll make income off the licensing fees and
exactly.
so on. So it does both things for me. It increases accessibility, which I think is really important in the mission of the NAGB, and it also allows the artists to make some funds. One thing I'm looking forward to with any 10 that we have to talk about is I like to do a limited edition of prints. We have to figure out some way of
yeah.
bringing that into our mixed media store,
yeah.
and not just to make revenue or raise funds for the gallery, but also to give everybody a chance to have one of those great artworks in their home.
Yeah. I think that's really what we want to do. I think you need to think about it. I think we need to become a little less sinister about like the commercial aspect of the creative sphere that we're in.
We can be more merciful.
We need to be more merciful.
Oh, good tie-in.
Very well done.
Very well done. So, John, we just have a few minutes left, and I wanted to know if you had any words of advice for any of the artists that have been selected or anything you'd like to say about any 10 here as we wrap up.
Wow. I mean, I don't know. I'm just, first of all, I'm very honored to have the opportunity to curate the show. Advice, geez, I'm not good at giving advice to artists, especially the ones who I feel are...
Because they're getting ignored anyway.
Oh, yeah, who are like, you know, it's hard to give advice to people who are better than you. But no, I just think it's just to be open, not to be fettered by the quotes or anything like that, just to kind of do what they do and just to be instinctual about it, because I think there's no answer. And second of all, there's no wrong answer.
Mm-hmm. Well, John, I got to say it's so great to have you with us today. The theme of the show is so inspiring and I think meaningful, and the timing is just incredible for that theme. And it's an honor to also have you curating this for the National Art Gallery. I think it's really got so much potential, and I'm really excited to see the show when it comes due. You know, it's not that far away. It's in July. I think July 7th is the opening date.
Yeah.
So that will come quickly, and it I'm will. Looking forward to it.
Well, thank you, John. And thank as you. We conclude another enjoyable episode of Blank Canvas, we would like to announce the opening of Kendra Farrow's The Whimsical Collector next week on Thursday, March 24th at 3 p.m. at the National Art Gallery. We will go until 9 p.m.
Right, right. So come all day.
Come all day. You know, COVID-19 protocols are strictly enforced, but it's going to be a very good time. So stay tuned for more information on that. Additionally, don't forget to come and spend time at the National Art Gallery. Our art park is open until while we're preparing for the opening of Kendra's show. But this is going to be, I feel like it's going to be a very exciting, interactive, you know, she does these wonderful three-dimensional pieces.
Oh, yeah, they're very inspirational. Definitely. Everyone will like it, from children's to adult will enjoy that show.
Absolutely. Well, take advantage of our Wi-Fi, and that is donated by Alive for our art park. And you can follow us on social media. Check out our website, www.negb.org.bs, for more information. Stay tuned to your favorite museum, and thank you for tuning in to Blank Canvas.